Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
I'm Spencer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Today we are doing a Bob and Richard Answers the Mail segment again. We seem to do these a lot, but you guys keep asking lots of questions, so we're going to do them a lot.
That, and we can't find any guests sometimes, so.
Sometimes that's the way it is, although we do have some scheduled, so always looking for more good guests. We have gotten a lot of suggestions for guests, some of which we go, I don't think so, and some we go, yeah, do you have an address and stuff, so keep coming in with suggestions, but just because somebody suggests we get a guest and the guest actually wanting to come on the air are two separate things. A few weeks ago, we did an interview with Maria Konnikova, who was responding to a question from Richard about sexism at the poker table. Maria said the phrase, little girl got to her. And she says the guy who was saying that would never say that to a big guy with lots of tattoos. I had a flip comment that maybe she should gain 100 pounds and get tattoos. Implicit in that is that she would not likely be called a little girl if she were not close to being little. When she mentioned she would also need testosterone injections, I said that sounded doable too. I received an email from somebody, a male actually, who was offended by my suggesting a woman gain weight to prevent sexist behavior that was very inappropriate. And perhaps it was. I definitely apologize to anyone who was offended. My comment was flip, spur of the moment, and reflected more of the response to little girl than anything else. When I make flip comments, sometimes I end up offending people unintentionally. Regular listeners of the show will know that me being a smartass at times is part of it. Hopefully most of you aren't offended by this most of the time.
I would just like to add to that that you imply that if you are overweight and unattractive that you won't be subject to sexism, which clearly that's not true. I mean, all
well, that was
women.
Not the intention of my implication, and yeah. I did not. So sometimes you don't know where people are gonna figures. So I, you can do an instantaneous calculation before the joke comes out, and sometimes you go, I made the wrong calculation. All right. At a particular casino somewhere, after the COVID opening up, you can play Ultimate Hold'em, three players at a table, but the dealers turn everybody's hold card over, which means you can see the other player's cold card. And this has to reduce the house edge as you can adjust your pre-flop strategy. Example, if you have King 6 off 6, off suit, basic strategy command you to play 4X pre-flop. But if another player has, for instance, King 10, you know there's one less king to play, thus you should pass. I've made money on this, the player says. He's actually looking for someone interested who can confirm that seeing the other two players' hold cards gives an edge if he plays perfect strategy at this game. So, Richard, do you know the answer to this?
Well, I put this question to the expert, which is James Grosjean, who has a new book coming out sometime, we don't know when, called The Ultimate Report, where he has thoroughly analyzed five games, high card flush, pie gout tiles. Oh, no, wait, I'm sorry. Those are not the five games. Anyway, he has a book coming out about five carnival games. But to this question, what he said is he asked, I'm looking for someone interested who can confirm that seeing two other players' hold cards gives me an edge if I play perfect strategy at that game. And James says he's not sure why he worded it that way. Has he read somewhere that seeing two other players' cards is an edge? It is not. First of all, let's call this what it is. It's card counting, not collusion. So all you're doing is counting those face-up cards that are on the table. With three players total, we're now making a pre-flop decision with six-card penetration. I ran these numbers within the last few months. It did not see an edge even with 18-card penetration, so a nine-spot game. Admittedly, I limited my analysis to pre-flop deviations only using human-feasible information on high matches, low matches, and overcards. If these details are all too confusing, let me sum up the bottom line. You cannot beat Ultimate Texas Hold'em by counting cards. So there you go.
So unstated is that if you can read the dealer's whole card, that's where your edge comes in, if any. Is that accurate?
Yeah. That's correct.
All right. Next question. His question says he is maybe just particular to his own situation and a goal he had for self. He's developed a strong video poker game concentrating on jacks or better and double-double bonus with good pay tables along with some Ultimate X vulturing. He also did card counting with a thirst to soak up the potential advantages there. So he's been studying, practicing, and putting into play around the Southern California close to where he lives. He's gotten backed off from table play at one location he enjoys staying at. Machines are okay. What would be the advice from the two of you if I play 5 to 10 hours a week, trying to put my bankroll in play wisely for building, but I would like to be able to earn comps and stay at certain casinos that have family-friendly resort atmospheres. If he was to be backed off at one or more places in tribal communities, would that information circulate? And what's the best course of action for play at places I may want to revisit with the family? All right. So you want to tackle this one first, Richard?
Sure. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with playing for comps. I think that's a great idea, especially if you want vacations with your family. I would just make sure do not count cards in those places where you're playing for comps. Video poker is a great way to do that, assuming they have pay tables that don't make it too costly. And if you want, you could play some blackjack, but don't spread anywhere, you know, don't spread enough that it's going to get you any kind of heat. There are a lot of places that if they're backed you off at blackjack, they'll still let you play video poker. So if you've been backed off from blackjack, do not try to go. If you're there to play for the comp, stick to the video poker.
Yeah, and good. I got nothing to add to that. Somebody says he has a buddy who he plays in poker game with is a backgammon player. This buddy convinced him to learn the game and gamble with him on an app since we can't play live poker during the quarantine. To compensate for the skill advantage, he lays me 2-1 on 7-game sets. And we have a system where we multiply the number of pegs or points won by the number of initial roll on the dice, with him always giving me the highest number, i.e. if the first roll is 6-1 and I win by 25 points, I win $150. If he wins, he only gives me 25.
What? Wait, you lost me here.
I don't know that. I'm reading it. But apparently he's getting a huge spot.
Yeah, okay, that part I got.
Player says he's a relatively fast learner, but it's still at a disadvantage to him if the game was to be played at even money. However, my gut is telling me he's laying way too much to me relative to the skill advantage he has. Over a relatively small sample size, he's up in the low five figures playing $1 a point, with 200 to 300 on sets. Although recently he's upped the stakes drastically, only to his detriment, and about half of the five figures is off the last 75 to 100 games. Player has run the math and roll multiplier averages. He thinks he's getting 7-3, which is slightly better than 2-1. His strategy is to play hyper aggressively when he has an initial roll. like 6'1 or 5'1 and conservative when he has a more favorable role, doubles or 6-5, similar to a loss rebate strategy. Also assuming over time he'll get wise to my edge and want to adjust him down, what odds do you think I can eventually concede to where I'll still have an edge? All right, so I'm going to try this one first, and then I'll let Richard at it. First of all, you have a cash cow here. And the question is, how do you milk it? Yes, you're being given too big of a spot. No, I have no idea what he's going to agree to next. The customary way for this to work is the odds keep getting worse and worse and worse for you, and eventually you quit. But you want to delay that as long as possible. The first question is, are you getting paid? In other words, if he owes you $12,000, is this marked on a piece of paper somewhere, or is it in your hand? You need to get the money before it gets too much larger. Propose a rule of whenever the score gets to be $1,000 or higher in either direction, the debts must be paid and start over again. If you never get paid, you have a lousy bet. The second key is don't get too much better too fast. If you start watching YouTube videos on backgammon championship matches and start playing like they do, he will notice that immediately. The only reason he's doing this is he can see errors you're making. The odds are so much in your favor, you can give this up. Finally, you say a large part of this debt has occurred in the past 75 to 100 games. That's called variance. It can go either way. Perhaps he's a lot better than you. I don't know. Know that the variance will swing the other way sometimes too. If you start to lose, then it's a time to watch the YouTube videos. You'll improve quite a bit fairly quickly, especially if you listen to the ones with commentary so you know why a player did something. If you've been losing, he'll put up with you increasing your skill. If you've been winning, he won't. So Richard, do you have anything to add?
To me, the biggest question is, how well do you know this guy, and how do you know you're not being cheated? I mean, if you're playing online, there have been tons of cheating scandals online at all of the, you know, online backgammon sites. So, you know, as Bob says, A, do you know you're going to get paid if you win? And B, how do you know you're not being cheated? Yeah, and as far as getting better, in addition to watching those videos, the other thing is to get a program called Extreme Gammon. Extreme Gammon plays better than any human, and it will, like video poker for winners, it will tell you every time you make an error, which could literally be on every play if you're, you know, just starting out. But you will improve much, much faster playing against Extreme Gammon, where it is telling you what the right play is and by how much. So, yeah, those are my thoughts.
All right. Next question is from a video poker player. He said, shortly before the casinos closed, he was excluded from point multiplier days for video poker at a casino that he plays a lot at because he's a skilled player and the multipliers are giving him an advantage. So far, apparently, he's not been excluded from mailers or drawings or other comps, although the mailer that he just got for June is half about what he had been getting. Now, he says that I have saying that sometimes I have talked myself out of restrictions or I can get reinstated. He wants me to elaborate how I've done that. Other possible relevant information. The player ran quite bad last year and lost money at this casino. This year he's up, but still down a lifetime. The last straw, it appeared, was him hitting a royal flush where he only held two cards to the royal. I'm a fairly big player and have a host. So my response to that is every negotiation is different. The fact that you're down lifetime is an important fact, perhaps, A lot of places know that card pulling used to work, or playing games with Ultimate X can increase your losses so that they're suspicious of their own records. Are there things this casino offers your tier level, perhaps a cruise or maybe free car washes or something, that are worthless to you? If so, offering to give up them is a possibility. Are the drawings relevant to your success? If they are too small or too hard to win, or only on days or nights you can't be there, volunteering to give them up can be worth something. You want to negotiate with the GM if you can get there. Negotiating with your host and expecting them to fight your battle for you is not a good plan. The fact that it was a 16,000-to-1 shot on the last Royal can be brought up. Clearly, that's an indication that you were lucky. But if it was a $40,000 Royal, perhaps, it doesn't matter what you say. At some places, the size of that sets off so many alarms that they're not going to negotiate with you at all. Finally, you're probably only going to get one shot with the GM, if that many. You must be ready. If that means practicing what you're going to say with somebody else, whatever. There's a certain amount of randomness in how this meeting can go, but when you only get one shot at it, you have to be at your best when it happens. Do you have anything to add about these things, Richard?
No.
All right. Somebody wants to our opinion about counting cards in an unusual way, what the advantage could be. If you count high-low, aces on a side, plus you count variable 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, I have a method that allows you to count three variables plus aces on the sides. Can you advise better application for such skills? The player thinks his method can bring very good results at Spanish 21, and this method makes it easier to learn counting for the regular person. Richard.
I don't understand. I mean, it sounds like he has these three variables, aces, twos, and threes in one group, fours, fives, and sixes in another, and seven, eights, and nine in another. Why you would want to do this, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me at all. You are focusing on the wrong things. So what count you use is not the important thing. Maybe if you were playing single deck, it would be worth it to use these various side counts. But what is important is the size of your spread, how deep is the penetration, and how fast are they dealing the game. Those are the things that make you more money, not how many different side counts you use. So I would focus on those three things and keep your count as simple as possible.
Very good. Somebody has a question regarding VPN. Is it legal to use the VPN on Brave or any other VPN to play online poker in a state that does not have online poker?
Well, the problem is, at least here in Nevada and in New Jersey, it won't work. If you're running any kind of a VPN, their software detects it and tells you that you cannot log in. So, if you found a way to get – a lot of people have tried to find ways around this. I don't know if anybody has actually found a workaround, but it's not going to be easy. And as for the law, I have no idea what the law states. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, and I've never researched it.
Yeah, we're going to talk to a man named David Hill next week, who is a writer, and he wrote about players in sports bettors in New York City who come 20 feet into New Jersey in order to make their sports bet, and then they go back across the water into New York, and that many have tried even halfway across the river which they're technically in New Jersey territory, but not. And they've tried all kinds of things and have not gotten through. So I'm assuming that's also going to be true for online poker. So good luck with it, but it's probably not going to work. Next question. Somebody says new table player restrictions is positive in regards to more hands per hour if there's only three or four players at the table instead of six. However, it all but eliminates wonging it. And please discuss the pros and cons of the new table and conditions on one of the upcoming shows. I've also read on some of the forums that some hole carding situations have been created from reflections coming off the acrylic section. Richard.
Well, first of all, the stories I'm hearing from the wild are that conditions are horrible because you can't get a seat. Because people were restricted from playing for so long, now once they get a seat, they're not leaving them, and so it's very hard. And the casinos, crazy as they are not opening more and more tables. Why they don't have every single table in the joint open is beyond me, because raising the limits. But anyway, as far as seeing reflections in the acrylic glass, call me a skeptic. I find it hard to believe that anybody is actually seeing reflections in the acrylic and can actually read a hole card that way. You know, maybe it happened once or something, or people get the idea that it might work. But as I say, I'm very skeptical of that working.
As am I, although Richard and I are both basically blind at our age. Yeah. So it is possible younger eyes can have an advantage there that we just can't imagine. Next is video poker question. It's about bankroll. Somebody says he typically likes to play 100 play draw machines, but at a 25-cent denomination, that adds up. That would be $125. So if he plays nickels, he lasts longer. In your opinion, is it better to play 5 to 10 hand draw at 25 cents or to play 100 play with nickels? So my answer is you don't mention the most important part. What are the game and pace, you know, and what are the pay schedules? Are they the same for both denomination? My philosophy is that I don't play at all if I don't have the advantage. And at the casino you mentioned in your email, I don't think there are any such games there. So I wouldn't play at all. If you really want to play for fun, go for it. But I can't answer which game seems more fun for you. I think you're going to lose at both of them. Next question is also video poker. He has seen a VP machine that say suited royal flushes. Are not all royal flushes suited? And my answer is yes, all royal flushes are suited. A game that says suited royal flushes usually has progressives on all four suits. So for a quarter game, you might find the spade royal is 1200, the heart royal pays 1600, the diamond royal pays 1100, and the club royal pays 1000 because it was just hit. To determine the value of this game, you take the average of the four royals. Correct play also requires you use four different strategies. That is, with those numbers, if you had a choice between holding a suited king, queen, jack, or a pair of jacks, it could well be that if the king, queen, jack were in spades, you'd hold them because the royal's high enough. But if the king, queen, jack were in any other suit, you'd just hold the pair of jacks. So it can be opportunities here, but there are four different strategies you need to use. Next question. Many APs understandably avoid showing ID in casinos. However, I'm wondering how one can play higher stakes table games without doing that. My understanding is that if you ever buy in or cash out for more than $10,000 in a day, you'll have to provide ID because the casino is obligated to fill out a CTR and some casinos will track even smaller transactions. It seems it would be pretty easy for a higher limit AP to run into this threshold. Of course, you could avoid carrying cash and use casino credit with markers, but that will involve showing ID too. How can one play at that level and still maintain anonymity with the casino? Richard.
Well, you're exactly right. If you get in 10,000 or cash out 10,000 in a day, you will have to show ID and they will fill out a CTR. So what higher stakes players do is not do on any of those things. First of all, I've said on the show many times, I never cash out after making a play. I always just head to the door and walk away with the chips. So the way you get around the 10,000 buy-in is you have the chips from the last time you played. And most pros stockpile high denomination chips in the places where they're going to play. And if you don't cash out, then you don't have to worry about cashing out more than $10,000. So, yeah, that's – and you know, sometimes you get in $9,000 and you just have to quit. So because you don't want to get close. You don't want to, you know, play it cute and try to go to 9,900 because they never keep an accurate count of how much you're actually in. So you could be in $9,200 and they suddenly come up and go, you're in 10,000, and you can try to argue with them, but basically they're going to tell you you can't play anymore unless you show ID. So, yeah, you stop if you're in 9,000.
All right. Somebody saw a pretty juicy promotion that he likes to take advantage of. To get the full bonus, he needs to run $32,000 through the machine. What kind of bankroll would he need for dollar full pay jacks or better machine for that kind of coin in? The two best tools for this would be Video Poker for Winner software and Dunbar's Video Poker Analyzer. Bankroll is always a probabilistic sort of thing, meaning it depends on you have such and such a percentage of losing so much. It's impossible to calculate it without knowing what your risk of ruin is. That is, a person who's willing to go broke 10% of the time will need half the bankroll as a person who's only willing to risk a 1% chance of going broke. With all that said, your average loss in $32,000 on that particular game is about $150. You'll have a 32% chance of losing $2,000 or more. So you need to calculate for yourself using one of the softwares how deeply you want to go. Somebody wants to know how I properly scout video poker games in a casino. For example, he goes to Casino A, sees that they have 8-5 bonus poker. He looks up the return on the Wizard of Odds and sees it's 99.1% return. He has a player's card and he gets mailers. How do I figure out how much my mailers and points are worth right then and there? Also, how do you actually calculate the dollar value of your points per play? Again, on the spot or thereabouts. Okay, this game does indeed return 99.17% if you play it well. I'm suspicious of anybody who says they know how to play the game well, but still has to look up on how much it's worth. Knowing how to play it well usually includes knowing what it's worth. You seem to want to know how much the slot club and mailers are worth right now, but you say you've already been getting mailers. So, how much are you getting in your mailers for how much play you've done? You know, how much did the slot club pay last time you played? Those are important data points, and you should be keeping track of them. Your question seems to be ignoring the information I already have. How do you do this? And my information is you can't ignore the information you already have because that's where the answer is. Insofar as mailers go, it's a good idea to swap information with a buddy. It takes a lot of data points to get a good idea of what kind of mailers a particular casino sends out. So check with a few other players who play approximately the same games and amount as you do. They might know more about Casino A and you might know more about Casino B. If you're a dollar player, it makes little sense to share information with a nickel player or a $10 player. The games are just too different. Or if you usually play the loosest games in the house, swapping notes with somebody willing to play 97% games makes no sense either. They will get much better mailers for you because the size of mailers often determine about by how much the casino is making off of you. Anything to add, Richard? Okay. For physical ticket drawings, do you know of any special techniques to make it more likely that your ticket gets drawn? Perhaps folding them in a particular way. There are lots of theories on that. First of all, physical ticket drawings are largely a thing of the past. Most drawings these days are virtual drawings. I tended to bend some of my tickets, but not all of them, because I never knew who was going to be picking it out. I have seen people picking out the tickets who intentionally avoid the ones that are bent because they did not want to give the advantage to people who were being tricky. So one theory I had would I try to put the tickets in near the last minute. So in case they get a person with short arms, it's the ones on top. This is especially true if the drum is really, really, really full, so that even though they spin the drum, the tickets don't move around so much. If there's a few enough tickets in there that when they spin the drum, they get really shuffled, whether you put them in at the last minute or not, doesn't really matter. Did you ever do ticket drawings, Richard?
Oh, yeah, a few. And, yeah, I would fold them, you know, bend them, whatever. But, you know.
Okay. A lot of video poker questions today. At a particular casino, somebody plays dollar NSU deuces wild, 9-7 double bonus, and 8-5 triple bonus poker plus. After he hits a four of a kind, he changes machines because casinos are unlikely to give 2 4 of a kinds back to back. Wants to know if this is a good strategy. Changing machine neither helps nor hurts you. The EV doesn't increase or decrease by any hand that just showed up. Even if I hit 2 royal flushes on the same single line machine within 5 minutes of each other, that would be no reason for me to change machines. I'm concerned about the game choices you listed. NSU is 99.7%, double bonus game is 99.1%, and the triple bonus poker plus is 98.7%. If you play at 800 hands an hour, which is $4,000 coin in, playing the triple bonus poker plus game instead of NSU costs you $40 an hour. That's a lot. There can be reasons relating to theoretical, or you get comps at a higher rate or something. But voluntarily giving up that much money on a play that's possibly break even, including comps and other benefits, is not a move that any player would make who had a clue about the winning process. All right. Somebody says he understands that jacks are better and bonus poker have a lower variance than, say, double-double bonus. But wants us to explain what it means to have a higher or lower variance. Variance is a mathematical term with a precise formula that makes for very uninteresting radio. Briefly, it's how often the deviations from average happen. In jacks are better, you get paid 2 for 1 for 2 pair. And it happens a bit more than 1 in 8 hands. If you only get paid 125 for four of a kinds, which happen every 420 hands or so, a double-double bonus, you get paid one for one for two pair, but a lot more on four of a kind, up to $2,000. Those are the two hands that account for most of the difference in variance. You get the little bumps frequently and the big bumps rarely. So that's what means a higher variance. So rarely you get the big ones, frequently you get the little ones. So the ones that are bottom heavy, like bonus poker and jacks are better, those have low variance. The ones that are top heavy happen very rarely. Those are the high variance. All right. Decided to let Richard join the show. So this is a question that says, Richard says scouting is important. What is it that we want to look for as advantage play? I assume that hole carding and things like dealer payout errors are exploiting side bets. If I'm trying to branch out into advantage play, what should I do and what should I look for in a casino? He plays blackjack counting cards, but would like to be able to scout other table games too, and wants Richard to tell him all of the secrets. Thanks in advance.
Yeah, I don't want to get into, what to scout for, but I would say this. You're a blackjack card counter. Do you scout all the tables before you decide to sit down and play? Is there one dealer that is giving much better penetration than all the others? You mentioned dealer errors. Is there one dealer that makes more mistakes than the others? Is there one dealer that's way faster than all the others? So, you know, those are things you can look for as a card counter. As for other games, I would just say read everything you can get your hands on. You know, get on the forums and the Discord channel and make friends in the Advantage Play community. And, you know, maybe they will privately turn you on to more opportunities.
All right. The next listener says he's been playing craps in Vegas for a number of years with some level of success, but he knows it's a negative EV game. He's wondering if there are strategies that provide the player with an edge. He's heard about dice control. Is there any validity to dice control or any other strategies? I'll let you try that one, Richard.
I'm not a believer in dice control. Well, I should couch that. We had Frank B. on the show talking about his experience with dice control. On his home crap table, he could actually demonstrate that he had an edge, but as soon as he went out and tried to do it in a casino, they would put a stop to it right away. So, yeah, I'm a big skeptic about anyone actually making money at dice control. Stanford Wong, who wrote one of the books on dice control, we had him on the show, and he admitted on the show that basically it did not work. Yet he still continues to sell his book on it, which I find odd, but yeah, so put me in the camp of very skeptical of anyone actually making money with dice control.
Well, the people who are making money are the people who run the Golden Touch Dice Control School. And they get you to pay $400 or $500 for however many hours.
Thousands, not $400 or $500.
Whatever it is. And so that's the way you make money with dice control, is you run a school teaching others how to do it. Somebody says he's interested in sports betting. Would Ed Miller or Captain Jack do a camp like the Blackjack Apprentice guys? And my response is Captain Jack Andrews is creating his own YouTube video every Friday. And at least for now, they're free. Listening to them, you'll gain a lot of knowledge, and he takes questions from all comers. So if there's anything you don't understand, send him a note. What his plans are for the future, I don't know. So Somebody wants to know our thoughts and opinions on the side bets offered in blackjack. Pairs, bust, bonus, poker, etc. Do you have any thoughts on those, Richard?
Yeah, you know, some of those side bets on blackjack are beatable through counting cards, but I never found them worthwhile, mainly because the limits on most side bets are so low that it just doesn't make sense to. There's much more money to be made doing other things. So now occasionally, casinos will offer some side bet where the limits aren't low, or, you know, the most famous one I think is over under 13, which had very high limits when it first came out. But for the most part, they're just not worth the time for most professional players because they can make so much more money doing other things.
Okay. Somebody wants to know why you don't like Apple products. The player thinks they're overpriced.
Well, yes. A, they're overpriced. B, they don't work and play well with others. You know, meaning it's often hard to integrate stuff with Apple products that they didn't make. Third, they, a few years ago, just changed their cables, and I had a friend who had to spend like $125 just changing all of his chargers. And you know, the other thing is, my partner Daryl, who's an Apple maniac, you know, every Apple product that comes out, I say, "Are you going to buy this?" And he'll always say, "Well, not on the first day," but he will buy all of it. And, you know, we would be many, many times, we would be in the same airport and his phone would not get any reception, so I could not call him on the phone. So those are just a few of the many reasons why I hate Apple products. So.
And another reason is they're frequently not backwards compatible. In other words, if it worked, they don't make their current version apps work on older products. So,
well, and the other way around, if you paid for software on an older one and you get a new one, a new Mac or something, now you got to rebuy the software again.
Yep. All right. Next question is for me. Would I ever consider doing any of the video poker classes online? Someone who doesn't live in Vegas but would love to attend a class, he'd be willing to pay to view and learn that content from me. I thought about it. I'm not at all competent in creating videos. We tried taping a regular class at the South Point, and that didn't work out well. There's too much ambient noise and background stuff. I put out some VHS test tapes some 20 years ago. And they didn't sell well at all. I'm grateful that you would pay, but I'm not sure there's enough like you to even cover the cost. So I have not been looking to do that. Somebody would have to convince me that that was a good use of my time.
You know, nowadays you could do a Zoom class, though, or at least you could see if there was interest in a Zoom class and, you know, charge for it that way if you wanted.
That's a possibility. Richards often talks about having a numbers guy as a key component for any successful player analysis. Do you have any tips for someone who's curious to learn more about what it takes to become a numbers guy? The particular listener has some level of programming knowledge, but is curious if there are any resources or ways to learn the logic behind how people did this. And since it was addressed to Richard, I'm going to answer it first. On the Wizard of Vegas forum, there are frequently threads discussing exactly what you're talking about. If you post some and become known, perhaps some of the other posters will share with you. So, Richard, now I'll let your turn after I picked off the low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, well, so you say that you know how to program, but you're, I mean, I'm a little confused by the question. If you know how to program, then, for example, one of our earlier questions, is, you know, was what about some particular side bet? Well, if you know how to program, you could find out the answer. Can I get an edge at this particular side bet by counting it? Right? I mean, so I'm not sure what you're asking. Are you asking what should I analyze? I don't know how to answer any more than that. Right. But as Bob says, find other guys and you know, you'll always do better expanding your network of people.
Yeah, there's a lot of people with some base games, like Michael Shackelford, for example, who's the Wizard of Odds, has a pretty generic program on Baccarat on which he can analyze a whole bunch of different side bets. And so once, and the same thing with video poker, where he can add this and that to it. So his own video poker software will do more things than the commercially available stuff. So if it's just commercially available stuff, there are skills in using that, and I've developed those skills, and I'm pretty good if it's on the commercially available stuff. But when coming up with new ones, I need help for that. All right, we are going to take a brief break for commercials, and then we'll be back with more questions, including one that I've been dreading, a black player asked Richard and I how to help him be an AP while being black. And this is a question that sounds like it has all kinds of potential to go sideways. So anyway, that's our first question coming back. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. That number probably is 6,000 now because so many of the every other machine is turned off. There's a lot of three-row machines or three machines in a bank where two out of the three are on and one is off. So throughout July, Spin to Win promotion will kick off from 3 a.m. to 2:59 a.m. Monday through Thursday. It's four times a week. If you every time you get $2,000 coin in on video poker or $500 coin in at slots, you get a free virtual spin at your machine. A player can earn up to four spins per day. Those spins will be either points or free play, counting points at free play at face value. In past years, the average spin has been $12, making this a 0.6% promotion. So since you also get your normal 0.3% cashback, this is triple points for the first $8,000 coin in each day, 4 days a week. What I actually do is get there after midnight on like Monday night, and then I will do between, say, I will play however long it takes before 3 o'clock to get both Bonnie's and my play done, wait until 3 o'clock to start again, and then play the rest. So I'm going twice a week to get 4 days worth of play. There's no change in EV. It just makes it two trips a week instead of four. One nice thing about this promotion is if you missed last week, okay, this week is still on. You can do it just whenever you're there and don't need to be doing it. If you miss a day, that's not a big deal. At predicted.org, it's a market where you can place small bets on the occurrence of various political events, mostly but not entirely in the United States. There's still big open betting on who the Democratic vice president nominee will be and who will win the election in various states. The price changes in recent months. The probability of Trump's winning has been decreasing, and so that definitely affects the price. If you're a good predictor as to what happens in November, you can make some money. Our listeners receive a one-time offer of a deposit match up to $20 at predicted.org/promo/edge. VideoPoker.com is the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get corrections on many of the games. The game of the week is Triple Play Dream Card. Dream Card is a 10-coin per line game where periodically we receive a dream card, which is substituted for the best available card before the draw. There is no special strategy required, and the feature adds EV over whatever the base game pays. There are two versions of Dream Card. One gives you the Dream Card on better hands, but less frequently. They both add approximately the same amount. So whichever version there is, it's going to add a small bit of EV. So let's go back to our listener questions and the one that I've been dreading. It's a comment from a player, and we're asked to comment, and he says he is a young, tall black man. He says he's known very few black APs. That said, he knows he's not like getting as an AP. They're not going to be easily. This is especially true if you're playing in an area that does not get a lot of black players in general. So that sounds right. And knowing that whatever two senior citizen white guys say is under extra scrutiny, please cut us some slack if we're trying to get this question. He says he's tall. If he's Shaquille O'Neal big, which means 7'2", weighs 350 or so, you're not going to blend in anywhere. But that would also be true of Dirk Nowitzki or Vlade Divac or other really tall white guys, or Yao Ming was a Chinese guy who was bigger yet. So none of those guys could blend in and be unforgettable. When they're trying to evaluate a player, in this case, skin tone would not be the issue, but height would be. So if you're all that tall, probably should pick a different profession. But if you're, say, 6'4", which is also tall, but not extremely tall, you're going to stick out, and you're black, you're going to stick out more in Minnesota than you will in Mississippi. There just aren't that many 6'4" black guys who also are 30-ish, wear short hair and glasses and a smoke. Now, I just made all the last part up, but that would be part of whatever profile you have. You're going to stick out more in some places than others because sex, age, size, skin tone, hairstyle, etc. are all things people use to judge you by. Now, in terms of blackjack, I'm a white guy in 70s with a gray hair that I prefer to call silver. But and there's lots of players like that. And so I have a better chance of blending in than I would if I were one of a kind appearance-wise. So if you're finding out that you're sticking out where you're playing, don't play in those places. I picked Minnesota as an example. I don't think the black percentage is as high in Minnesota as it is in other states, but it might be. So if you live in Minnesota, fly to Mississippi to play. Richard.
Well, yeah, I agree that you're going to get much more leeway at the beginning, and then it's going to be hard for them to forget you. So once they do pick you off, you're just going to have to stay away from those places for a long time. But, you know, you want to play into their stereotypes at the beginning. So I, too, have known very few black advantage players over the years. There are some, maybe there are a lot more I just never met, but I've only known a few. They did get more leeway in the beginning. One of them who was tremendously successful, was very good at playing into their stereotypes, and often they thought, because of the way he dressed and the things he said, they thought he was a professional baseball player. So, you know, they just gave him an enormous amount of rope because they thought he had a lot of money and they weren't afraid of him. So, yeah, I mean, try to use that as, to your advantage. And, of course, you're going to do better in places where you're not the only black face in the casino. So those are my thoughts.
This next question is for both of us. It's that
we should probably make this the last question. We're running out of time. So.
Okay. It says, since you're both practicing storytelling for a while now, have you thought about writing or podcasting your life as a professional gambler? Well, I do a weekly blog, which you can find on gamblingwithanedge.com or bobdancer.com. Maybe 10% of those stories are gambling experience. In my first book, Million Dollar Video Poker, is an extended story about my life as a gambler up to 2001. In this week's blog, there's a story about my wife's 75th birthday party where Richard's wife stiffed me for $10 on this bet. Now, that's one story. It's more of a lighthearted piece than it is about serious gambling. And on June 21st and 28th is a two-part story of situations I was involved in where organized crime may or may not have been involved. I'm not sure. And so that's coming up. Depending on when you hear this, it may already be out there. Richard.
You just said June. Did you?
I did mean July. Thank you.
Yeah. You know, I thought about it and I realized there is, I may have made, you know, $1 or $2 an hour on the last book that I did. So, that really sort of quashed any, ideas I had about writing another book. I like personal storytelling. I would rather get up on a stage and tell a story than write a book. So.
All right. So thank you. We have lots of questions left, which you know what that means. We're going to do this again soon. And keep them coming. There's always room for more. And,
do you have a recommended this week, Bob?
I actually do. We are preparing for our next week's blog, which is a guy named David Hill. David Hill is a writer. And he... writes gambling stories among many other types for some top situations. So if for some top magazines and top periodicals in a way similar to the way Michael Koenig used to do, or perhaps Michael Kaplan. So a lot of his stories are really fascinating. We're going to be talking to him about his new book on a casino in Hot Springs, Arkansas. But a lot of his stories that you can find online are very readable, very interesting, and it's and we'll put the link in the show notes. Richard, do you have any recommendations?
As an aside, a couple of months ago he had a big featured story about Spanky, which I had posted, I think, on the Gambling with an Edge Facebook page and the and Twitter. So, but we will put a link to his page that'll have all his articles. So, he's a very good writer. My recommended this week is only for those people who have Disney Plus. So, for the 4th of July, I watched Hamilton, the musical, which is sort of the biggest Broadway hit of the last few years. And it was great. The two leading ladies, in particular, they just filmed the Broadway show, It's not a movie. It's just a film of the Broadway show. It was shot, I think, in 2016. The two leading ladies just had extraordinary voices. So, yeah, I thought it was really great. So if you have Disney Plus and you haven't seen it, you might want to check that out.
Very good. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.